Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Targeted Talks. I'm your host, Nicole Tucker. In this episode, Dr. Jason Luke, a medical oncologist and director of the Center for Therapeutics at UPMC Hillman Cancer Center, and an associate professor of medicine, leads a discussion with Dr. Sandeep Patel, a medical oncologist and associate professor of medicine at the University of California, San Diego Health, about the present and future of immunotherapy in cancer. Dr. Luke begins the talk.
So getting started in this discussion, first I'd like to thank you for joining us. I think you've really been one of the leaders in immuno-oncology development through the SWOG program and really leveraging, you know, the great resources at UCSD. In starting this discussion on immunotherapy, I thought maybe we would talk about the landscape of what things look like. And given that you're a disease expert also in thoracic malignancies, I thought maybe you could touch upon, you know, just how integrated immunotherapy has now become with standard of care approaches.
Absolutely. And Jason, it's an honor to be able to do this podcast with you. You've really led the field in terms of biomarker discovery, translation in cutaneous malignancies, and trying to make what we call cold immunologic tumors hot. And so some of these novel agents will really help us there. I think both of us, one thing we share is the desire to bring immunotherapies and immunotherapeutic knowledge from the biomarker space really across multiple tumor types. And I think, when we talk about cutaneous malignancies and thoracic malignancies in particular, these are some of the initial homes for these therapeutics. And I would say the current state of IO in thoracic malignancies is we have anti-PD-1, anti-PD-L1 directed hammers, and every problem looks like a nail right now. And so whether it's combining with chemotherapy, whether it's moving, we just saw some data at AACR in the neoadjuvant space, which is very promising. The adjuvant data, we've had some reports that immunotherapy works. And I think none of these are surprising, right? In the melanoma world, these are all things that you're well aware and actually help push the field forward on. But I think really what I think all of us are looking forward to are the development of therapeutics to help those patients that don't respond to anti-PD-1 directed therapy or anti-CTLA-4 directed therapy. And I think that's the importance of conferences, you know, like AACR and some of the other conferences we recently seen data on, is we're starting to see that next generation of immunotherapeutics. But I think the key is we have to start to understand the biomarkers that belie the subgroups. And if it's okay, we can maybe spend a little time talking about the history with IDO, right? So this is a drug that I think many of us thought a class of drug that'd be beneficial for patients. And it likely may still have a biomarker selected group of patients that may benefit. But when we treat all patients with a combination of PD-1, it didn't show a benefit. And I think the surprise isn't that strategy didn't work. I think the surprise to me is that anti-PD-1 works on so many different types of cancer.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, to that point then, where do you use PD-1 in your standard of care practice for non-small cell, for small cell, for meso? I mean, is it just, you just use it all the time?
It's pretty much the backbone of all the non-driver mutation, non-small cell lung cancers. So if you have an EGFR, ALK rearrangement, targeted therapy is your best. And there are other targets in which small molecule inhibitors are your optimal target and targeted therapy. Pretty much for everyone else, it's IO, chemo IO for frontline non-small cell lung cancer. After chemo radiation in the stage 3 setting, consolidation, durvalumab for a year. If we're looking at small cell lung cancer, it's chemotherapy plus an anti-PD-L1, whether it's atezolizumab or durvalumab. Mesothelioma, we now have frontline data for the combination of CTLA-4, PD-1, ipilimumab, and nivolumab versus chemotherapy alone. And so it very much is a scenario in which it's chemotherapy plus the PD-1 and in some scenarios versus CTLA-4. How would you feel in terms of the cutaneous environment? Any recent changes that you've noticed there?
Well, you know, I think immunotherapy has been a hallmark of melanoma therapeutics for decades, right? I think we've been fortunate and unfortunate in the melanoma space to not be hindered by the prior history of chemotherapy, because chemotherapy essentially had no efficacy. So therefore, we're not wedded to chemotherapy combos. But that being said, I mean, so certainly frontline in melanoma, we use PD-1 or PD-1 with a CTLA-4. We'll get to other combos here that are actually looking quite promising with phase 3 data coming forward as positive. But I just wanted to emphasize that point. No question frontline, but it sort of seems like basically anywhere that we've seen a PD-1 approval in later lines of therapy, it's now just become the case that it's now just added to the frontline for whatever the other previous one one was. So just a touch on other malignancies, obviously in the GU space, right, in kidney cancer, PD-1s were originally approved in the later lines, but now combined with VEGF-TKI, and even in bladder cancer, sort of same thing. It's now moved up, you know, as a maintenance after chemotherapy, or maybe now even an adjuvant, as we've sort of alluded to. So I think really understanding anti-PD-1 and, you know, the modest but real toxicities that we face when we use these drugs, I think is important as we think about them. But setting aside sort of standard of care then, I think you started talking about those biomarkers and next generation approaches. And do you want to speak at all about TIGIT as what looks like a really hot, you know, molecule, especially in the lung cancer realm?
Yeah, and so we're always looking for the next best thing because when patients unfortunately have progression on IO or chemo IO strategies, there are not as many tools in the tool shed as we'd like from an immunotherapist perspective. Getting to those next therapies, I think, is crucial. I think TIGIT is one of the more interesting ones in thoracic oncology. It's being developed in non-small cell lung cancer and small cell lung cancer. And the way to think about TIGIT, it's part of a broader pathway that works on TIGIT HVEM, which sounds like alphabet soup, but fundamentally these are antiviral programmed responses. And I think it's important for us to remember that cancer effectively is stealing from the body's native playbook to shield itself from an immune response. If I'm in the lab and I want to get PD-L1 positive control, I'm using the placenta. Why? Because half of the fetus is immunologically foreign to the mother, right? So the placenta has to have a robust immunologic barrier. And so TIGIT and all these other pathways represent natural ways for the body to dampen down overactive immune surveillance. And so a lot of these are breaks on the immune response. And TIGIT actually acts on a slightly different pathway. But broadly, it looks like in combination with PD-1 inhibitors, there may be some synergy. Now, one of the issues with TIGIT, and I know we'll talk more about some of the other novel therapeutics, and I was alluding to this earlier with IDO, is it's unlikely that many of these drugs are going to be grand slam home runs across, you know, 20 different cancer types, right? I think PD-1, PD-L1 really has uniquely had efficacy across so many different cohorts. But I think we've seen some recent data with the atezolizumab combinations, pembrolizumab combinations. There was recently something at ACR showing some data for TIGIT monotherapy. My sense, though, is these will likely be common trial strategies, but one of the issues we have in the field fundamentally is we're just combining everything with a PD-1 inhibitor because we're assuming all our patients' immunologic problems are PD-1 plus novel therapy X rather than getting to the biomarker space. It's as if we did NGS testing and we gave dabrafenib, trametinib to everyone, regardless if they had a BRAF mutation. That's effectively what we're doing with IO development. I think that's part of why we struggle. And so one of the areas I'm most interested in is an area you're an expert in, is how we biomarker select patients to make sure to optimize their outcomes and personalize their immunotherapy.
I think it's worth pointing out, and this is relevant to TIGIT as well as another molecule that you know, listeners will be interested in called LAG-3. Yeah. You know, in our sort of fundamental working models, that some patients have mounted an immune response against the tumor, and we can measure this by the infiltration of CD8 cells or PD-L1 expression. But really, a lot of the secondary checkpoint molecules that we've been interested in targeting, just conceptually, really are only going to be present when you have a very robust immune response. So going back to the TIGIT example in lung cancer, the original, the study that really put this on the map, which I think was called the Skyscraper study, was a study in the front line of lung cancer with high PD-L1, where they showed that adding the TIGIT could improve on PD-L1 monotherapy. So again, the model there, though, is that that's where the target is in that high interferon-associated tumor microenvironment. And then similarly, you know, in melanoma, we've recently seen data around an anti-LAG-3 antibody called relatlimab. And conceptually, this is actually somewhat similar, where in melanoma in the front line, the majority of the patients are going to have a high interferon-activated tumor microenvironment with high CD8s, high PD-L1, but that's where you're going to see high levels of LAG-3 expression as well. And so a number of companies developed LAG-3 antibodies some years back, and the early consensus was it doesn't work, in air quotes. But, you know, that shows that the importance of biomarker stratification and doing the right kind of clinical trial to find those patients. And so in lung cancer, that's the front line with PD-L1 high, in melanoma, again, in the front line. And so I think, you know, that's a really important thing to be aware of, is that these secondary checkpoints are likely only going to be really effective where PD-1 already has activity, because that's where the biology is. And so, as you were alluding to, the biomarker and the biology are intertwined there, which I guess is kind of an obvious thing to say. But we haven't been following that so closely, you know, over the last few years, which I think is why it's been slow with development.
And the other point, I think, Jason, and you bring up a great point there, is with genomic biomarkers, the genomics is that cancer's destiny, right? If you find a BRAF mutation, regardless if you biopsied in the adjuvant setting, in the relapse setting, if it's that cancer, that genomics is unchanged. It's like a stop sign, right? Meanwhile, for these IO biomarkers, they're more like a traffic light, right? Meaning they're dynamic, they change over time. When we get the biopsy relative, which lesion are we biopsying? And so this isn't, when I say our IO biomarker development has been hampered, I don't mean this as it's a lack of trying. It's that it's more complex because these are dynamic changes on circulating immune cells, which is very different than our genomics. And if you look, and we had several plenaries here at ACR, part of the reason we're getting so many good genomics drugs is we're finding these targets. We're able to accurately identify these patients who have these targets, and we're able to give drugs that are engineered. And so one of the issues is, in IO biomarker development, we see the efficacy of the agent, and then we try to backfill what the biomarker story is potentially. And so one of the areas I'm most interested to see in LAG-3, for example, is at least in the phase one, phase two drug development for relatlimab, it seemed as if LAG-3 expression on the T cell seemed to confer with clinical response. And I think that's one of the areas in the melanoma study I'm most interested in seeing, is if that dynamic biomarker is inducible. It changes over time. So when were the biopsies done? Mm-hmm. What were the levels? Because these things matter. Because as you mentioned, when you give interferon gamma, or when there's interferon gamma stimulation, or whatever the stimulation is, radiation, whatnot, it changes the biomarker. And when you take that photograph, matters.
Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to emphasize quick, though, on a practical reality for maybe practitioners who don't follow these trials quite so closely. There's been a longstanding discussion about combination immunotherapy as being more toxic. And so how have you understood that vis-a-vis the TIGIT combination?
Yeah, I think combinations just by addition tend to be more toxic. But, you know, at least the data we've seen for TIGIT is, at least in the small cohorts we've seen, drive up the rates of the toxicities most concerned about. I think with immune checkpoint blockade, the more common toxicities we deal with in clinic are mainly cutaneous or thyroid related. And those tend to be minor, and we tend not to have to interrupt or even give steroids for. The ones I think we worry about and keep us awake at night are things like colitis, pneumonitis, myocarditis, you know, neuro-ophthalmic autoimmune complications, which are exceedingly rare but very concerning. Those don't seem to be particularly higher. And I think one of the, the immune response is a double-edged sword, right? Meaning those therapies that are most likely to make a quote-unquote immunologically cold tumor hot, and I only use that as a heuristic to describe the immune microenvironment. I know it's a crude one, making cold tumors hot, you're much more likely to have friendly fire on the immune response, because that's by virtue what you're trying to do to the tumor microenvironment. You're equally stimulating an immune response against, you know, normal epithelia. Meanwhile, if you're making warm tumor hotter, right, which is what TIGIT and some of these other molecules seem to at least be doing preclinically, though we don't know for sure, you're likely not as immune active and leading to as many of these IRAs. So sometimes the biology tells us the toxicity in the sense that it's a double-edged sword, at least as far as these drugs go.
Yeah, so I think that's a really great point. It was one thing I wanted to really emphasize, is that both with the TIGIT combination and with the LAG-3 combination, it does not appear that toxicity is increased. So I wanted to get this out on this podcast, especially in that when we talk about combination immunotherapy being more toxic, it's really that CTLA-4 antibody is toxic. It's not so much that blocking these checkpoints is necessarily more toxic. And for that reason, listeners should be aware there is a lot of ongoing effort now to do things like bispecific antibodies to hit more than one checkpoint at a time. And I've been working on this a lot. And again, just to emphasize that if you do this right, it doesn't have to be more toxic than monotherapy approaches. But so people could keep their eyes out for those kinds of approaches. Slightly shifting gears on that, though, you alluded to this, and it was one of the next topics I really wanted to hit on, which is those therapeutic approaches, which really are trying to modulate interferon responses to be more, sort of cold to hot, like you were alluding to. So there are a number of things like pattern recognition receptor agonists, like toll-like receptors and STING agonists, as well as direct cytokines that are being developed with this idea that you could modulate. So do you want to speak to those? Like, where do those stand? And how is the toxicity profile of those approaches different than what we've talked about so far with checkpoint blockade?
No, it's a great question. I think it's an area both of us are interested in, because it's a way of expanding the opportunities for immunotherapy to more patients. And so there are many immune cells, right? And I think, you know, kind of like in ancient Greece, you had a heliocentric version of the universe, right? Right now, the immunotherapy universe revolves around the effector T cell, as far as we can tell, right? But there are a myriad of immune cells that are likely relevant to the immune response, cells we want to augment, such as NK cells, M1 macrophages, and then cells we want to get rid of, right? Like MDSCs, regulatory Tregs. And it's even more nuanced than that. But just to give a mile high overview, that there are many planets in this immunotherapy solar system, and we've really only explored one to date. So the idea is, as we look at some of these other immune targets, we talk about TIGIT and LAG-3, are there ways we can target macrophages, right, with CSF1R? There have been some studies looking at that, PI3 kinase inhibition, NK cells, right, through NKG2A, NKG2D, some of these NK cell checkpoints. And then the don't eat me signal, right, is probably the furthest along, mainly in the hematologic malignancies, but that's a macrophage-based checkpoint, CD47. And so you see different toxicities, because when you activate a different cell, you get different toxicities. For example, with the CD47s, you tend to get this red cell agglutination with some of those antibodies, and you actually get a little bit of hemolysis. That's being engineered out in some of these version 2.0 molecules. But the idea that not all immunotherapy toxicities are the same, and the original immunotherapy all of us trained on, which was high dose interleukin-2, right? That was you admitted the patients to the ICU, right, or the step-down unit, and you basically induced sepsis, right, every 8 to 12 hours, and hoped you induced enough sepsis to get an immune response. We're basically, seancing with Cooley's serum, which was the original immunotherapy from 100 years ago. And so all these immunotherapies have their own side effects. CAR T, I think people in the hematologic malignancies are very used to those cytokine release IL-6 mediated sure. toxicities. But you know, one question I had for you is we have drugs that have existed, but that we're combining or therapies that have existed that we're combining in novel ways to unleash an immune response. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on how we can best integrate these therapies.
Well, I think you're touching on the VEGFR2 combinations. This is particularly relevant. You know, this goes back to something we spoke on in the beginning, which was combining with standard therapies. So it makes a lot of sense to consider VEGF blockade in combination with immunotherapy, because there's a lot of preclinical literature that supports T cell trafficking and release of hypoxic tumor microenvironment. But it's becoming increasingly clear, though, that using these small molecule TKIs actually does something more than that. And it's one of these things where we don't actually always know everything before we go into a clinical trial, because it certainly looks like across many different tumor types, that small molecule TKIs in air quotes that hit VEGFR2, but also hit a cornucopia of other targets seem to be disproportionately active. And so people are well aware in hepatocellular carcinoma and renal cell carcinoma that VEGF TKI plus PD-1 is a thing, but it's also a thing now in endometrial cancer, where we see that neither drug appears to have a much activity on its own, but you put them together and all of a sudden you get something. And similar trials are being pursued in prostate cancer, in rare forms of melanoma, in a number of different diseases. And I think it just goes to show that some of this resistance to immunotherapy we don't understand well enough, and that just maybe a sprinkling of chemo actually might help a little bit there. You also touched on the radiation combinations, and that's something I've been very interested in as well. I think it's an evolving story, but one really important point I want to hammer on this is don't use radiation thinking that you're going to have this putative abscopal distant effect thing. We don't see it. We've done many trials. It's not to say it couldn't ever happen, but it's not worth thinking about right now. That being said, there's a lot of discussion in the literature about safety of radiation with immunotherapy, but I want to really push on this. It's totally safe to do. Please do it for your patient. Don't be concerned that you're going to cause a toxicity. It isn't to say you can't ever have toxicity, but we've treated hundreds of people now. And in clinical practice, there have been, maybe millions of people treated, and there's really not a toxicity spectrum. So providers don't need to be worried about that combo. Irradiate away, debulk tumors, and improve, you know, the lives of patients. One toxicity I do want to come back to, just to kick it back to you, was talking about that cytokine release, because you alluded to that. I want to just close on the innate immunity part and the cytokines to sort of note that there are a lot of ongoing studies to try to figure out ways to deliver highly potent type 1 interferon driving molecules like toll-like receptor agonists and STING agonists and cytokines. So people should be on the lookout for that, because there are phase 3 trials ongoing. But, you know, how do you manage those, I guess, is what I want to come back to. Because in the hematologic space, obviously, they have the patient in the hospital. But if you start generating cytokine release and your patient's ambulatory, how do you deal with that?
So cytokine release is the immunologic tumor lysis syndrome, right? It's a toxicity we don't want, but the fact we have it means we're doing something that is a shot on goal. Cytokine release syndrome for CAR T typically has a very predictable kinetic. It tends to be, you know, day three to day up to 14, really, after their CAR T infusion. They're usually in the hospital anyway because they're cytopenic. You know, they have an indication likely like leukemia, right, or a refractory lymphoma for which they're in a hospital anyway. For drug development for cellular therapeutics on the outpatient setting in solid tumors, it's really about education of the patient and the caregiver, right? And these are living drugs that you're giving. And so you're planting the seeds along with giving, you know, the crop at the same time, meaning the whole benefit of these cellular therapeutics is they evolve into a memory type cell long term, and they're kind of a constant sentinel against the cancer. But when you really think about immune checkpoint blockade, and Jason, this goes back to your earlier point, we're giving prodrugs when we're giving anti-PD-1, anti-CTLA-4, so on. The actual drug, ideally, is the patient's own antigen-specific T cell. And the reason I bring this up is it goes back to your point about holding radiation. You can't hold immunotherapy in a sense in terms of radiation because the cat's out of the bag once you gave the dose, right? The real immune response is from their own immune cells. So I sometimes get questions about, oh, do I hold the immunotherapy before surgery or radiation? A, to your point, there's been no safety signal. We've had a lot of surgical and a lot of radiation studies, so you don't have to worry about that. But B, when you think about the biology where these are prodrugs, it's like holding Lupron, right? The ship has sailed. And so similar to cytokine release, sometimes these toxicities are delayed. It's really about education and just making sure patients know what to be aware of. You know, I think this is an area I've started to do some wearable clinical trials, like for, you know, patient safety monitoring. I think this may be an area that may be helpful, but really it's all about education of the patient, caregiver. They get wallet cards and you know, our EMR at our institution, I had a program. So when they get any of these therapies, when they hit the ER, the hospital, it shows they're on an immunotherapy. It tells them who to contact and how to, you know, manage initial toxicity, rule out infection, things like that. And so I think like many things with immunotherapy, these are great drugs and some patients can live years and years, but we got to make sure they're safe during their journey. I think these tools help us.
Yeah. Do you have any comments on CAR T cell in solid tumors? Just very briefly, it's obviously an emerging field, but kind of where do we stand with that?
So CAR, fundamentally, the reason it's a chimera, chimeric antigen receptor, is you're making a Frankenstein's monster of the antibody from a B cell, and it's an antibody drug conjugate, except the drug is a living effector T cell, right? And so you need a target that you can effectively annihilate, right, and not have any long-term side effects or overlap. So in liquid tumors, right, you don't need CD19 to live, right? You can have complete B cell aplasia and you just need to get revaccinated. You'll be okay. And maybe some IVIG. It turns out with BCMA for multiple myeloma, you know, that's not a cell type that's not a protein that's on normal cells that would lead to any issues. For solid tumors, it's a bit harder because most of the cell surface proteins do something else, or they can have overlap where you can have toxicity. Probably the solid tumor CAR T that's furthest along is the mesothelin CAR T. But we have to be careful because mesothelin is also expressed on the myocardium, obviously on the lining of the lungs, right? And even in the eye, right? And so we just have to be very cognizant of these toxicities. And so my sense is for solid tumors, the CAR T will often involve what's called a suicide switch. Basically, it's programmed so that you can give a therapy, whether it's oral or IV, and kill off all the engineered T cells. It's part of that construct. The way you make a CAR T, right, is you take out the patient's immune cells, you freeze out the cells you want. And nowadays, you basically do a transfection step through B. You're putting in a cartridge, right, so to speak, into the cell to reprogram it. And part of that cartridge is the suicide switch. But I think other therapeutics may be interesting. I'd love to hear your thoughts in an area you've led in terms of TCRs and TILs. And I think this is a good strategy to make cold tumors hot. So I'd love to hear your thoughts along those lines.
Yeah, so just building off the CAR T example, obviously there are other ways to get lymphocytes to go after tumors, and we can sometimes engineer them, and we can sometimes rely on the natural presence of them in some tumors. So as opposed to a CAR T, which is an engineered, you know, receptor, like you, I liked your actual illusion of a bispecific molecule that actually one side of it's a living molecule. The T cell receptor transduced T cells are a slightly different modification. It's actually inserting a natural T cell receptor to sort of home those T cells into tumors. And there's some interesting results coming forward in synovial sarcoma and a number of different areas. In terms of tumor infiltrating lymphocytes, this is also a therapy that, you know, providers should be aware of because it's possible it could come into standard of care within the next year. we know that in tumors, you can find lymphocytes. And many groups, you know, probably most famously led by Steve Rosenberg at the NCI, have spent decades actually cutting those tumors out and harvesting those lymphocytes, growing them in the lab and being able to give them back. And in melanoma, we're now seeing that even patients who are refractory to checkpoint blockade, we can get upwards of a 36% overall response rate with a very durable response by doing this sort of a therapy. And it's expected that this kind of a therapy is going to be approved by the FDA in the coming year. So all of these concepts around cell therapies, around cytokine release syndrome, we wanted to emphasize these because this isn't really pie in the sky. Obviously, people are doing this for bone marrow transplant and for heme malignancies, but these concepts are going to be coming to standard of care for a number of malignancies, I mean, in the very short-term future. And people should be gearing up to understand how they're going to be able to deliver these in order to help their patients. Well, that's been a great discussion, you know, given that how much ground we've covered. You know, do you have any final thoughts maybe before we wrap?
Yeah, I think it's been a great discussion. And I think the couple themes that stand out to me, I think the future of the field is really bright. I just don't think we're going to have as many hits as PD-1, PD-L1. And I don't think that should be a disappointment. I think we got very particularly lucky with anti-PD-1 therapies being effective across so many different tumor types. You know, it's one of these 80-20 rules. I think it's Pareto principle, right? You know, the last 20% is going to come from novel therapeutics, likely in combination, but really going back to what got us here, which was understanding the immune microenvironment, right? And we talk about personalized and precision medicine. It's not just a buzzword, it's how we, you know, move the field forward. And so we've seen that with targeted therapies. There's probably nothing more personalized than harvesting a tumor from a patient's own body, taking out their own immune cells, engineering them and giving them back. But the idea that we need to understand exactly what we're doing so we can measure it and help understand which patients benefit. Because what's made targeted therapy development really blossom is the advent of a multiplex panel with next-generation sequencing. We yet do not have that. And even the biomarkers we have, like PD-L1 IHC, tend not to be perfect biomarkers. And so I think if there's two points I can make. One is that we need to develop the biomarkers in parallel, not just for patient selection, but for drug discovery. But two is it also helps us understand how we can best manage immune-related toxicities by understanding the mechanism. What we do for a patient with IL-2 in the hospital, very different than CAR T-cell patient, very different than a person getting a PD-1 inhibitor. And really, it comes back to education of the clinic staff, because at least in my clinic, my nurse is probably the one who gets the E-True Hollywood story about the side effects, right? And so making sure the whole treatment team is well aware of the toxicities, because we can help the patients manage those, and we can generally help them get back safely on that therapy or something else. And so I think, you know, having that kind of relationship where we can navigate these patients through these difficult therapies, and they don't need to be so difficult if they're educated, because the outcomes can be so good. Yeah, Jason, what absolutely. Are your thoughts on some of the key learnings you've had? Because you've really been involved in this space since the first day.
Well, yeah, no, it's come a long way. And I think, you know, the thing to focus on is that we've moved to a space of tumor biomarkers, and we need to move to a space of patient biomarkers as well, right? And that, I think that goes to your discussion around immunotherapy biomarkers. But just to summarize all of this, I think, you know, the field is very bright. There's a lot going on, which includes near-term likely changes to the standard of care with TIGIT and LAG-3 and lung and melanoma and then beyond. And then beyond that, there are a whole host of novel therapeutics, but this is where we need the biomarkers to really figure out how are we optimally going to employ them. And then just finally, just to note that cell therapy for solid tumors is almost upon us. And so we want to make sure people have heard that, because that infrastructure and that education around the differences in toxicity for cytokine release and other things that we've discussed here is going to become an integral part of the management of all patients, not just those who are on the BMT service. And so I hope that in this discussion today that, you know, those listening can, you know, hear that and, you know, start to ramp up their own practices in anticipation of this, because obviously you want to be able to have all of these therapies available for your patients, you know, no matter what happens, you know, as soon as that is possible. So with that, I would say thanks to Dr. Patel. I think it's been a really great, you know, conversation today, and have a great AACR, and hope I see you in person sometime before the end of the year.
Likewise, Dr. Luke, this is great.